On this week's 51%, we speak with sociologist Allison Daminger about her research into cognitive labor and how couples today are divvying up the planning and decision-making behind childcare and household chores.
The vast majority of them were what I call woman-led. Their decision-making tended to be shared, right? But it was usually only after she had done a lot of that prep work to get them to the decision stage.
I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. The holiday season is upon us, and while many people find it's the most wonderful time of the year, it can also be a stressful one. There's a lot to figure out, like what are you going to have for Thanksgiving? How are you going to decorate the house? What might the kids want for Christmas? Can you afford it? And who will travel to whom for holiday parties and family celebrations? It can feel like a laundry list of decisions to make. And if you're a woman in a heterosexual relationship, you are more likely to be the one doing that mental work. Our guest today is Allison Daminger, a professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin. For 8 years, she has interviewed couples about how they divvy up a type of domestic labor she calls cognitive labor, the planning, research, and decision-making that goes into raising kids and keeping a home. Sociologists like Daminger have been studying household labor for decades. And to be fair, the gender gap in this area is narrowing, with men in the U.S. contributing more to household chores than ever before. But Daminger says the mental load of family life often goes unseen. Her research so far has found that even among egalitarian couples, women are still more likely to carry the brunt of this work in heterosexual relationships, and same-sex couples don't always share it equally either. Daminger summarizes her findings and explores the different factors at play in her new book, What's on Her Mind: The Mental Workload of Family Life.
I define cognitive labor as the work of figuring out what you and your family members need, what you need to provide to others, and then making sure that you fulfill those needs and obligations. And it really has four chief components. So the first is anticipation, right? You have to figure out, okay, what is coming down the pike that we might have to deal with? It could be very simple. What's for dinner tonight? It could be very complex, you know, where should we send our child for kindergarten next year? Step two is identifying options, right? Most needs you can fulfill in a number of different ways, whether picking from a range of recipes or picking from a range of schools, if that's something your area offers. And so you have to narrow it down to say, what are the possible ways that we could address this issue? Step three is making a decision. Right, by now you've got your assembled options and you want to figure out what's going to work for you and your family. What is your value system? What is your budget? Right? What is more and less feasible? So you might say, okay, it's takeout tonight, right? It's a long day of work. We do not have the bandwidth to cook. Or you might say, okay, we're going to try the local public school down the street. That's the easiest option. Let's start there. And then the final step is monitoring. We're following up to make sure that whatever you decided on actually addressed that first need, right? So oftentimes when we make a decision, we are relying on someone else to carry it out, right? So if my husband and I sit down and we talk about what's for dinner, I might say, hey, could you pick up this ingredient on the way home? Then I need to follow up and say, did you actually get it? Right? Or if I'm making a decision about where to send my kid to school, maybe it's, all right, I sent several emails trying to schedule tours. Have I heard back from the school administrators? If we are trying to solve a problem, right? You know, I have an infant at home, and so our constant problem is how do we get her to sleep more? So we're always trying things, right? And then we have to evaluate and say, did that work? Or do we need to try something new? So that is the final monitoring stage of cognitive labor.
And what got you interested in the subject and made you want to research and write a book about it?
You know, this was something that I sort of stumbled upon. I got into grad school intending to study something completely different. And I sort of serendipitously stumbled across a few interesting things. Number one, I did some pilot interviews for a project that never got off the ground, but I intended to actually study how parents made decisions about where to send their kid to school. So the example I just gave you is not a totally random one. It's one that I was actually thinking a lot about. And what I observed in those interviews was most of the parents that I spoke with really emphasized that they had made a decision together with their partner. They would say, "Oh, yes, we really thought long and hard about this, and we decided to send them here." And when I probed a little bit, asked some follow-up questions, I quickly learned that usually that we was led by a she, right? It was she who said, "Hey, this is coming up, right? The deadlines are approaching. We're going to need to start thinking about this." It was she who polled her friends and said, "Hey, what have you guys done? Right? What are my options here? What do you know about X school or Y school?" It was she who looked on the websites, copied down all the times for tours, got them on the family calendar, made sure her partner, knew to be there at that time. And then, with all that information in place, we made a decision. And so that experience of doing those interviews happened around the same time that I was learning about classic research on the division of labor in households. And I saw that most of that research was really focused on how many hours men and women were spending on chores and childcare. And what I realized was that most of the work that went into making decisions was unlikely to be captured in those time diaries. Right, because it was happening inside someone's head, often while they were doing something else, right? The categories that people are asked to record their time in don't map very well onto these sorts of activities. And so that got me thinking about, we know a lot about how mothers and fathers use their time differently, but what do we know about how they use their minds differently on behalf of their families, and what effects might that have on them?
So you spoke with nearly 200 people, many of them complete couples for this piece. Tell me about how you went about interviewing them and what you found out about how they divvy up cognitive labor.
Yeah, so this research project unfolded in a few different waves. I added new data as I, generated new questions. My first round, I was really interested in different gender parents, right? A man partnered with a woman, who were raising young children, 0 to 5, and where both partners had a college degree. And I picked that group because I expected that, number one, they would have a really high cognitive labor load. Right? New early parenthood is kind of infamous for being a stressful, busy time. And now that I'm in it, I can confirm that was a good population to pick. I also picked more highly educated folks because population data suggests that they tend to have more egalitarian views about gender. So I wanted to kind of look at a best case scenario, right, where people would be more likely to have this intention to share work. Then over time, I broadened out. I added a round of parents with more varied educational backgrounds, with older children, and I also added parents who were in LGBTQ plus relationships. And what I found with the heterosexual couples was that the vast majority of them were what I call woman-led. And what I mean by that is that in those couples, she did the majority of the cognitive work for their family. She was the one who was by far anticipating needs. She was the one who was doing most of the monitoring. Their decision making tended to be shared, right? But it was usually only after she had done a lot of that prep work to get them to the decision stage. Now, one out of the five heterosexual couples was either balanced, right? They split cognitive work roughly 50-50, or even man-led, where they put more on his plate. So I always like to mention those couples because I think sometimes people think that it's all heterosexual couples where she does more, but there is variation that I observed. And then, of course, in the queer couples, right, there were some examples of balance and sharing this work equally, but there were more examples of imbalance and sharing this work relatively unequally.
In the woman-led couples that you spoke with, I guess what was their reasoning for dividing up work the way they did?
This was the most fascinating part to me. I went into this research with a hunch, based on that pilot data I told you about, that women were probably doing more of it. But I wondered how they would explain it. And what I heard over and over again was, this is not a gender thing. This is a personality thing. My interviewees pointed to personal differences between themselves and their partner, right? They said, She is type A. She's super organized. She's just on top of everything, maybe even a bit of a control freak. And they said he is laid back. He goes with the flow. He's present in the moment, right? If a bit disorganized. And that makes a lot of sense, right? We know that there are personality differences across the population, and that shapes the way we show up in various aspects of our life. But what I saw was that those personality types were really strongly gendered. Almost always, the type A superhuman was a woman, and the type B bumbler was a man. And that just doesn't align with what we know about population level differences by gender and personality. It seemed like this was more of an explanation rather than what was actually driving the behavior.
I mean, maybe this is an assumption on my part, but I have to assume that the partners that fall into, I guess, the quote unquote bumbler category aren't bumblers at work. It sounds like it just, switches off at home, I guess.
You're exactly right. So I talk in the book about how, although the folks I interviewed really pointed to personality, I think cognitive labor is more a function of your skills, right? It takes skill to be always planning ahead, right? It takes practice. And the skills that are required overlap quite a bit with many of the skills that all of us use in our professional lives, right? Managing a calendar, being organized, tracking projects in different stages of completion, right? Following up with people who told us they'd give something to us. And men that I interviewed, like women that I interviewed, held down jobs that called for the very same skills that they were said to lack at home. There were a number of men I interviewed who were professional project managers, right? Or who were consultants or lawyers or surgeons. And so, what I argue in the book is that it's not that they don't have the skills necessarily, but that they're not deploying them in their home life in the same way they're deploying them in their professional lives.
So why is that? I'm guessing this is maybe where gender roles and socialization factors in.
I think so. I think that, for one, mothers and fathers, men and women, are still held to very different social standards. Women are much more likely to be held accountable for domestic outcomes, like did your child get to school on time with a matching outfit and, their clarinet for band practice, right? How does your home look when people come over? Men, meanwhile, are held accountable for things like how does your lawn look when people come over, right? How much money does your family have? Are you providing enough for your family? And so what I think, consciously or unconsciously, most of my respondents were doing is sort of strategically allocating their limited bandwidth in ways that they knew would be most efficient for what they were held accountable for. And so for women, that means I need to preserve a good chunk of my mental space to managing things at home, right? Whereas for men, they felt that they were primarily going to be held accountable for things like financial provision. And so it makes sense that they would be deploying much more of their cognitive space on their paid work.
At the same time, though, the same-sex couples you spoke with weren't always necessarily balanced in their division of cognitive labor either. Tell me more about that.
I think it's a misconception that, heterosexual folks sometimes have is that if only, I were in a same-gender relationship, sharing housework wouldn't be so hard. It wouldn't be so fraught. And what I found is that overall, the majority of the queer couples that I interviewed were imbalanced to some extent, meaning that one partner did more of this cognitive work. But there were a couple differences that I think are important to point out. Number one, those couples had smaller gaps between partners. So it wasn't like 80-20, partner A is doing more than partner B. It was more like 60-40. Number two, these couples were much more aware of those gaps than your average straight couple, right? When I talked to them about it, they would say, "Oh yes, we've talked about this frequently. My partner sent me an article they saw online, and we've discussed it, right?" And so it wasn't something that they were unaware of. In contrast to many of the straight couples who seemed to me as though they hadn't really thought about these issues, and they were coming up and really having realizations in real time during the interview. And a third factor is that when it came to, how the queer couples divided cognitive work, they did not fall into a kind of female role and a male role, right? It wasn't that one partner took on most of the jobs that women did in heterosexual couples, and another partner took on most of the jobs that a man did in heterosexual couples. They kind of mixed and matched in idiosyncratic ways that they argued, reflected their individual circumstances and preferences and strengths. And they also felt like if they wanted to, they could change it, right? Whereas many of the straight couples seem to feel like, well, this is just who we are, so we're stuck with this particular allocation.
As you mentioned earlier, about one-fifth of the couples you spoke with were either balanced or man-led, as you describe it, where the male partner takes on most of the cognitive labor. But you say in the book that comes with its own obstacles. I guess what are some of those?
So I have a chapter in the book about different gender heterosexual couples who share cognitive labor or put more on his plate. And what I found is that those couples faced a lot of social pushback, right? And what I mean by that is that, for example, I talk in the book about one mom who was not usually at the pediatrician appointments for their child. She had a much less flexible job than her husband did, and so he was the one who managed the relationship with the pediatrician. But he was sick one day, or something came up, and she took her daughter to the pediatrician. And she got a lecture, right? Oh, it's nice to see mom here once in a while, right? And so that sounds like a small thing, but over time, those little messages that, hey, you are doing something wrong in your role as a mom or in your role as a dad, they can add up. Right. And these couples felt like it was worth it to them, that it was okay that they were going to be comfortable pushing back against those societal judgments. But it did seem to stick with them and sting in some cases.
That's got to be tough. Yeah. You know, I hear from a lot of moms that that feeling of mom guilt comes almost no matter what you do.
Yes, I think that a lot of the moms that I spoke with felt that constant pressure and felt like they were never measuring up to this impossible standard that society had told them was a good mother. So that drove a lot of them to be really concerned and worried, particularly about how things were going with their children. Another challenge that these non-traditional couples faced, particularly the men in those couples, was that they sometimes struggled to sort of reconcile the way that their family life had turned out with the way that they had expected it to turn out. Right. So these men tended to expect that, they'd be the primary breadwinner, their wife would take on more of the lead role at home. And things hadn't worked out that way, right? Often it was because her career took off in an unexpected way. And so he stepped up at home. And for some of those couples, that was hard, right? That they had gotten all these messages over the course of their lives about how a family is supposed to be run. They recognized that they were doing something different, and something about that sometimes grated.
We're speaking with Alison Damminger, author of What's on Her Mind. You mentioned earlier that for a lot of the imbalanced couples you interviewed, this was their first time learning about cognitive labor in the home. Did you find any of them were able to, I guess, achieve a more balanced arrangement after talking about it?
It's a little hard for me to say because I only interviewed them once, right? What I
Okay.
can say is that I always sent a follow-up thank you email, thanking them for their time and for sharing their stories. And I heard in a lot of the responses to those emails something like, "You sparked a really good conversation between my partner and I." And so I have a sense that many of those couples, after I completed the interviews with both of them, sat down and talked about, what came up in your interview with Allison and how do we feel about it. So I don't know whether that led to lasting change, but I do have a sense that it at least sparked some new discussions.
I mean, is it possible, I guess, to get a more equal division of labor here if you start with an unequal one?
Yeah, so I do think it's possible. I think it's hard, right? And I don't want to sugarcoat that. One of the challenges is that, as I said earlier, this is a function of skills, right? And we build skills the more we practice a task. And so oftentimes, by the time a couple gets to the point where they're unhappy with their division of this work, they've put in years, right? Where one partner has been building these skills and the other has not. And so those skills gaps are hard to close. I do think it's possible, right? And I think it starts by really taking an honest look at where you are, right? And how it maps onto your ideal and your value for your family, right? If you are happy with where things are, it doesn't have to be 50-50, right? 50-50 is not the gold standard by any means. It's just for many individuals, right? When they feel overburdened with this work, it takes a toll. And so I think for couples who are like, this is unequal and it's hurting one or both of us, then I always encourage them to be really strategic about where they start. I think trying to make a massive overhaul is probably a recipe for disaster. I always recommend picking one or two tasks that you can totally hand off to your partner, right? And not just have them be responsible for executing the task, but for thinking about the task, for following up, right? For doing the research, all of those cognitive steps. And you want to pick something that you're going to be okay letting go of, that you're not going to be really worried about your partner messing up. And so, for many people, because of what we've been talking about in terms of how women are held accountable, right, we want to pick something that is more internally facing and is less likely to expose you to the scrutiny of others. So, something like, what is the family going to eat for dinner, right? And not, what is our child's birthday party going to look like? So, starting small and then building confidence, right, that these things are not set in stone, but with concerted effort can be changed. Over time, hopefully that momentum builds and can carry over into other aspects of your life.
I think that's a good idea to, to start small and with something that your partner can safely, I guess, quote unquote, fail. Because, practice makes perfect. And if you have to step in and correct them or monitor them, then are you really taking it off your plate?
That's what I heard from a number of my woman interviewees in particular, was they tried passing something off to their partner, but they still worried about it. Right. And so they would say things like, it's not fully off my plate because I'm always wondering if he did it. And so that's where picking something strategically and getting really clear with each other about, okay, what are the standards here? Right. What will constitute done or good enough? And saying, what happens if something goes wrong? Who's going to be responsible for cleaning up the mess, so to speak? Because oftentimes women worry about if that task goes wrong, if that task is undone, if your child shows up to school without the homework, right, you're going to get the phone call. And so I think talking about standards, talking about what to do in the event of someone dropping the ball, that helps with the transfer.
Well, I know the book is still new, so I hate to ask the what's next question, but did your research turn up anything for you that you would like to continue looking at?
Absolutely, yeah. So, one of the things that I'm really interested in is, as we've been talking about, the men and women who I interviewed as adults often pointed to personality, right? And they said, I've always been this way since I was a kid, right? This is who I am. And so that really got me thinking about childhood and what are the origins of what seem like personality differences in adulthood when it comes to how we approach our home life. And so my next project is looking at how parents across the political spectrum are thinking about raising sons, right? We know that there's a lot of discourse these days about masculinity. People have very different feelings about, what's good, what's bad, what's wrong, what's right, et cetera. So I really want to understand, how are parents approaching it? How are they thinking about raising the next generation of men? And what might that foretell for how families will continue to change and evolve in the coming decades?
That sounds fascinating, and I look forward to hearing about it. Allison Daminger is a sociology professor at the University of Wisconsin and the author of What's on Her Mind: The Mental Workload of Family Life. It's out now through Princeton University Press. Allison, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you for the invitation, Jesse.
As the holidays draw near, families and businesses are preparing for an onslaught of toy shopping, but with it comes an annual initiative to inform consumers about which toys could have technology or safety concerns. Alex Simone of the New York Public News Network has more.
among the top toys on this year's Trouble in Toyland list, released by the New York Public Interest Research Group, are ones that use AI features and items that could pose safety hazards, like water beads and knockoff electric scooters. Buffalo State University psychology professor Pamela Schutze Pizarro says AI use in toys means functions like cameras or microphones could be used to acquire sensitive information. But she also says the toys could impact children's behavior.
There's also concerns about the fact that these toys are designed to mimic social and emotional relationships. And children can become almost addicted to that type of a social relationship.
Oshai Children's Hospital Trauma Injury and Prevention Coordinator Ben Casper says micromobility toys, like e-scooters, e-bikes, and others, are relevant, especially if they're knockoffs that might not meet required safety standards.
The aesthetics might be there, but the functionality and the regulations are oftentimes not. So that's one thing to really take into consideration. A lot of times, I know it's the holiday season, if price is too good to be true, it is.
Casper says another top concern is any item that children can choke on, like water beads, so it's important that parents learn CPR and other anti-choking measures. Alex Simone, New York Public News Network.
Finally, November 20th marks the annual remembrance of those who have died as a result of violence against transgender people. Transgender Day of Remembrance began 26 years ago in honor of Rita Hester, a transgender woman who was killed in 1998. Nearly 60 people have died since last November. To learn more about Transgender Day of Remembrance and the violence and erasure transgender people face, WAMC's Samantha Simmons spoke with Marlo Garant, a psychology professor at Union College in Schenectady, New York.
It was established after Rita Hester was killed in 1998. She was a Black trans woman who was active in the trans community in Boston particularly. And after she was killed, there was initially really no mention at all of her death. And then when there was some mention, it was dead naming, it was misgendering, things like that. So one of her friends, an activist, basically said, you know, we need to do something about this, right? We need to have more visibility. We need to remember the people that are experiencing this in the way they'd want to be remembered, not the way they get remembered in media, or maybe not remembered at all.
Your background is in gender studies at Union. So can you talk to us a little bit about why there is such a difference on how trans people are treated? One, because of the gender they're presenting as, the gender that they are, and also why it impacts different people differently. So like you said, Black women are, you know, high targets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there are a few things behind that. Some of it is just the nature of transphobia. But what we particularly think about in that regard is the nature of intersectionality. So this idea of people's diverse identities interacting with one another. And so, for example, Black trans woman isn't just, and I say just not to minimize it, but isn't only experiencing transphobia. She's also experiencing some level of sexism or misogyny. She's also experiencing some level of racism. So we're seeing the sort of confluence of those different aspects of, you know, violence or discrimination or just sort of structural exclusion from different systems.
And how can people year-round, obviously Trans Day of Remembrance, November 20th every year, but how throughout the year can people support the trans community to make it a better, more protective place?
Yeah, if I'm thinking, you know, I mentioned part of what really, really started Trans Day of Remembrance was Rita Hester being misgendered and deadnamed in, you know, in media and initially just being ignored or sort of invisible altogether. So I think there are ways that people can build on that, certainly thinking about things that should be pretty low-hanging fruit in the grand scheme of things that anyone can do, like asking someone's pronouns if someone tells you their pronouns. Work on getting those right. Now, I would say names as well. And I'm thinking for allies, too. I know for me personally, right, it feels really impactful when I see people use their pronouns, regardless of whether they're a member of the trans community or not. So I'm thinking of things like that as well. And then certainly just, I think particularly, you know, given, I would say recently, you know, some of the invisibility of trans populations, I think using different platforms, particularly for allies, particularly for the trans community, even like white trans folks, using platforms, using some of the relative privilege different people might hold to elevate the voices of trans folks, particularly those more marginalized trans folks, you know, show up at different community events, elevate in terms of like social media kinds of things. I think those sorts of situations are things that anyone can do for the most part.
You just mentioned the sort of erasure or invisibility of trans people, especially, you know, in the past year specifically. Have you noticed any change in climate locally, and what does that look like?
Yeah, I think I've seen things kind of go two directions, right? The downside, if you will, is that I think you've seen a lot of, I would say, trans folks, particularly trans folks from other marginalized groups, be a lot less sometimes comfortable in certain spaces. I think you've seen a lot of trans folks in general who are having to make hard decisions about whether to be visible as a trans person or whether to try to just sort of blend in, or in some cases even worrying about, you know, maybe should I go back in the closet, things like that. And I would also say, because of those things, right, I like to say that while things are bad, and that sometimes feels like an understatement for trans folks right now, if we look across, you know, sort of broader queer history, often when things get bad, it's because things are kind of at a tipping point in some ways, right? If there wasn't that level of visibility, no one would care. And so I think on the flip side, right, of sort of community things that I've seen, I would say there's also been a lot more community cohesion. There have been a lot more spaces where allies, you know, really show up in a way that before maybe they would have liked to show up, but maybe didn't feel like as much of an urgent need. So I think that has certainly been a positive thing as well.
That was WAMC's Samantha Simmons speaking with Union College psychology professor Marlo Garant about Transgender Day of Remembrance. Transgender Day of Remembrance was November 20th. Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. You can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King for 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night and down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool.